Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Okay, so it was just a few days after the 4th of July in 1877 when prisoner William Taylor and 2 fellow inmates escaped from their island prison in Puget Sound.
They caught the other 2 on the island, but he managed to get a boat and just kind of disappear into the sound.
This is Dave Beals. He's the historian who told us the story.
So guards had to pursue him via rowboat. So one guard,
of course, he's in a rowboat too.
Right, right, yeah.
So it's a high speed rowboat.
Exactly,
chase.
Yeah. So they don't know where he is and can't find this guy Taylor anywhere.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect. You're hearing KNKX's Paula Whistle and Simone Alisea with an excerpt from their original podcast, Forgotten Prison.
First, the guards head toward the mainland. They look in Steilacoom and can't find him. They even hire 2 Native American trackers, whom they often use to find escaped inmates. Still no luck.
So one guard jumps back in the boat and starts rowing north.
And saw Taylor up in Tacoma at Point Defiance Park on the shore, but Taylor saw him coming too. So Taylor jumps in his boat and they just go in this incredibly slow speed rowboat chase in Puget Sound.
Now, the guard in pursuit is rowing as fast as he can.
And then finally he catches up. Somehow the guard didn't include this, but he just says, caught him and apprehended him, which I don't know how that works. Once you catch somebody.
Jumped into his rowboat.
Right. Once you pull up in a rowboat next to another rowboat, how do you bring the inmate back? But they brought inmate Taylor back.
Once captured, Taylor was forced to row the guard back to McNeil Island Prison, where the inmate was once again locked up.
Today on our show, it's Tales of Washington's Forgotten Prison. The big house on McNeil Island actually predates statehood, and its history sheds light on criminal justice, on a changing society, and on human nature. Here to talk about it are the brilliant minds behind it, KNKX's Paula Whistle and Simone Alisea. Welcome, guys.
Thanks, Gabe.
Thanks.
So how did this begin? How did you guys figure out that this was an interesting thing to spend, 6 months of your lives on?
Well, truth be told, the Washington State History Museum was planning an exhibit, and they came to us and said, we would really like to do a podcast with this. And so Simone and I were lucky enough to go out to this abandoned prison and start crafting a podcast to go with the exhibit.
Well, one of the interesting things about it, I think, is that it is on an island, right? And so it's sort of remote physically, and that also makes it kind of remote in the imagination a little bit. Like that's like a wild place that's so different from wherever, you know, the rest of the world. And you're kind of demystifying that.
Right. And I know people know about Alcatraz, but nobody knows about McNeil Island. And its history in many ways is way more fascinating. Like you said, it was there before we were even a state, and it was actually operating as a prison until 2011.
You hear about a prison closing, and I think the first response is, okay, who cares? It's a prison.
Right.
And so I think going into it, we were very much expecting to talk about sort of the ghosts of McNeil Island, if you were, right?
The famous inmates who
were
there.
Yeah, yeah. And then the more we talk to people, both inmates, people who were locked up there, guards who worked there, and members of their family who were on the island, it really started to complicate this view of what prison is and the sort of darker aspects of it. You really started to hear stories about why this place was important to people in their lives and the memories they had of the place.
Well, and people lived there, you know, much of their life there. And especially walking through the abandoned prison, I mean, you just see all this evidence that people were there because they just kind of walked away, and there's still all this sort of Chernobyl-esque look to it. You know.
The dead zone.
Yeah.
Well, we're about to listen to some of that. This comes from early on in the podcast, Forgotten Prison, and it is what I gather to be your first or one of your first trips through the facility, right?
I think it was the very first time.
Yeah, and we just kept going, whoa. I think, I don't know how many times someone said, holy Moses.
Yeah. I mean, it is pretty shocking when you're seeing it for the first time.
So let's have a listen to that. This is from the podcast Forgotten Prison, coming to you from Sound Effect.
Ooh, careful. Standing water with slippery growth. Wow, there's like vines growing into the door.
Remember when we said this prison closed in 2011? Well, when that happened, the state kind of just left it here. It's pretty much abandoned.
When the state shut down McNeil, they did what's called a cold closure. It's when you just turn off the power and walk away.
I have to say, I feel like I'm in a haunted house right now.
Haunted prison,
right. I guess probably even scarier.
It's like people here just vanished. You can still see signs of them everywhere, in the warehouse where inmates made furniture.
So there's a whiteboard here, and it's got a kind of creepy drawing on it. It says, "This too shall pass."
Or the old personnel files in the administration building.
95, 97. I wonder if someone must have been looking for something.
Like just everyday signs of the human experience.
Perfectly good roll of toilet paper there.
I know, you might steal that.
But still, it's shocking to see how much the place has fallen apart in less than a decade. The paint peeling from the walls and the way the blackberry bushes are taking over everything. And then there are the animals.
God, they're just like dead birds everywhere.
Oh, dead skeletons of dead birds.
To really understand why, I think you first have to realize that McNeil has been forgotten many, many times.
Throughout McNeil's history, it was always on the back burner, or always people were pretending they couldn't see it.
Dave Beals again, the historian with the rowboat story.
Basically every aspect of this island prison's history was a surprise. It's like McNeil found its way into every chapter of U.S. prison history, but was always in the shadow of something else.
For whatever reason, McNeil Island hasn't really broken into pop culture, unlike, say, Alcatraz.
Which is weird, because McNeil...
It kind of served as this testbed for...
Alcatraz, the rock. No one has ever escaped from this prison.
This trailer is for the movie Escape from Alcatraz, made in 1979.
Clint Eastwood is Frank Morris in Escape from Alcatraz.
You see, when McNeil first opened in 1875, the fact that it was on an island wasn't really about stopping escapes, even though that's how we kind of think of island prisons today. It was really just where land was available. It would be decades before the feds would build a prison for the, quote, worst of the worst. But when they did decide that was a priority, the remoteness of McNeil served as a model for its more famous California counterpart.
Alcatraz was the first prison of that idea, that there needs to be a place that is inescapable, supposedly for the largest escape risk, worst of the worst. And then when they needed to open it, they brought in 14 inmates from McNeil Island first.
Almost everyone has heard of Alcatraz, but even those who have lived here for a while knew little, if anything, about McNeil Island. I think part of it is Hollywood. That Clint Eastwood movie is just the start. In the 60s, you had the Birdman of Alcatraz.
Who, by the way, was at McNeil first.
And then there's recent stuff, too. Michael Bay made a movie called The Rock, which involves breaking into the old prison. J.J. Abrams also had a sort of sci-fi series that reimagined Alcatraz's closure.
You know, it probably helps that you can still go there and see Alcatraz. This is from a video posted to YouTube in 2016. And it's what Alcatraz, the tourist attraction, sounds like today. Now, in the video, you see glossy signs and displays that lay out the history in a way that's easy to understand. The place is crowded with all kinds of people.
Compare that to McNeil, whose history needs some cobbling together and where a visit involves background checks and a flashlight.
Of course, it's so dark we can't see it.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're joined by my colleagues Simone Alisea and Paula Whistle, who are talking about their original podcast, Forgotten Prison, all about the prison on McNeil Island. So what makes the prison on McNeil unique?
Well, a big thing about it, and wardens and other people we talked to would say, you know, other, especially federal prisons, have 30-foot walls around them. There are no walls. I mean, there's concertina wire, but there are no walls. So everybody, whether it's the guards or the inmates, they can see Mount Rainier when they go outside. They can, you know, maybe hear the sound of the water.
And, you know, it's on an island. I think that's really the big thing. When it closed in 2011, it was the last prison in the country accessible only by air or water.
Is that the reason that there's no wall, is that it has water instead?
Yeah, that was the escape deterrent, although it didn't always work. A lot of people escaped from McNeil.
A lot of people, really?
Yeah, over the years, during both the federal and state era, yeah, that's the misconception. People think, oh, it's hard to escape. But actually, there's one area, if they were out working on the island, at low tide, it wouldn't be that hard to get across.
I think people did, practically walk to Key Peninsula from the island.
Well, let's give a listen to a piece from the podcast here that gets into some of those issues, starting with the prison yard and talking a little bit about what it is like for the people on the inside to interact with the outside.
So everyone we've talked to has said that the yard has a view of the water, and that was really important.
Unlike a lot of other institutions, there was never a 30-foot wall around the prison. Being on the island has given the people who were locked up here a somewhat unique experience since the beginning. By the time the state took over in 1981, McNeil had a reputation for being a better place to do your time.
For this call. This call is from
Timothy Pauley,
an inmate at Monroe.
Tim Pauley is one of the inmates who thought McNeil was one of the better institutions. He says part of it was the scenery, but it was also the animals on the island.
Having that opportunity to interact with wildlife like that was, it really made my life a lot better.
Tim is currently serving consecutive life sentences in the state prison in Monroe, Washington, for the 1980 murders of three people at a tavern in SeaTac. He spent time at McNeil between 1989 and 1991, and then again between 2008 and 2010.
So before we continue, we just have to take a moment here to acknowledge Tim's crimes and explain why you're hearing from him. The murders he was convicted of attracted a lot of media attention, and it's come up again recently as he's fought for parole. Families of the victims have been clear they do not want him released from prison.
But Tim has been incarcerated for a long time. In order to understand what prison was like, especially life at this particular prison, we wanted to hear from the people who were here behind bars. It's not for me and Paula to say whether Tim should be locked up, but he can tell us a lot about prison itself.
Here's what Tim says about McNeil.
When you spend enough time in prison, we're all just kind of locked in here, and very seldom do you ever run into anybody that's really glad to see you. And I'm going to tell you that those raccoons were glad to see me. I'd come home to my little cubicle, and they'd be sitting at the window waiting for me, and I'd feed them every day.
Tim, like other inmates, had a job while he was at McNeil, which brought in a little bit of money every month.
Sometimes I'd spend half of my paycheck getting stuff to feed them with, and that was just, I don't know if I'm describing this well, but it just seemed like it was really a memorable experience for me.
Tim said something there that will stick with me. Very seldom do you run into someone that's glad to see you. The connection he made to those raccoons is not only very real, it paints a really clear picture of what prison can be like.
Tim says the isolation he often felt doesn't take away from the fond memories he had of McNeil. But for some other inmates, there really weren't any good memories.
Basically, the main takeaway I got from McNeil Island was never live on an island.
Paul Wright was at McNeil from about 1999 to 2001. He now lives in Florida after serving a total of 17 years in Washington for murder.
Paul has been an advocate for prisoners' rights since he was first locked up. He started the Prison Legal News and the Human Rights Defense Center while he was in prison. So, unlike some of the other folks we talked to, Paul has very clear opinions about prisons, and even clearer ones about McNeil.
Just from a logistical and a financial and a management perspective, having a prison on an island is a really stupid idea.
He's referring there to the fact that McNeil was expensive to run, and it's why officials say they closed it in 2011. But Paul's dislike of the island is personal, too.
it's, at least for me, the part that was the most oppressive or rankled the most was the problems with the visiting and the visiting facilities. It was
very- Paul says he and his wife at the time had two small children. One problem was that visiting hours were limited,
which made it difficult for anyone that worked to be able to visit.
He also says they didn't allow strollers or backpacks, which is a problem when you have a six-month-old and a two-year-old in tow.
The two-year-old couldn't walk that far, and my wife couldn't carry both children at the time, so basically it meant I didn't get any visits.
In all, he found the experience even more isolating, not to be helped by views of the water and Mount Rainier.
You know, the cage can still be in a nice surrounding environment, but you're still in a cage.
So we just heard from an inmate who spent time in the prison on McNeil Island. McNeil Island is the subject of the podcast Forgotten Prison, produced by KNKX and my colleagues Paula Whistle and Simone Alisea. And you'd think that, you know, what Paul describes is more or less what prison is like, right? It sounds pretty bleak, but it sounds like there's a real culture that develops there.
Anywhere where you're living day-to-day life, right? Anywhere where you're going through your day, you have meals, you have classes, you have work, you know, the people that you're with are going to become a part of your community, and that those experiences can be good or bad. They're typically not unilaterally one or the other.
Now, some people will credit the environment, that it was had a calming effect, being on the island, being able to look out and maybe see an eagle or see an orca go by.
That would chill me out. Well, let's take a listen to some of that. We're going to hear from a particular former inmate here, right? Who is that?
So Brian Funk was at McNeil Island for about 7 years in the late 90s and early 2000s. And he was released from prison after having served a total of 19 years back in 2014.
Prison is a complex social system. You have to know who you can trust, and information is valuable.
There wasn't things that went on without us discussing it. We would typically know where a guy came from. Did he even come from D unit and just get moved to B unit? And why was that? Did he tell on somebody to get moved? Did he have an issue with his cellmate to get moved? Is he hot right now? Which means obviously the guards are watching him and, you know, drugs, whatever it is.
It's interesting. One person we talked to described prison as high school with knives. But maybe the addition to that is like high school with knives for like a decade.
No, it's exactly like high school, like I remember it. Everybody was treated kind of the same way that they would be in prison, you know, judged and were, you know, it was those cliques. When I got to Colum Bay, there was Muslim tables, you know, there was white boy tables, and there was, you know, Nazis, basically, whatever. There was Crips and Bloods still and all that stuff. And things have changed over the years. And so everything was, I don't know what else to say, segregated by our cliques that we created. And yeah, it was high school with knives and for decades.
But inmates don't just have to navigate their relationships to each other. When you think about it, guards are also spending most of their time in prison, 8 hours a day or more. That adds another level of human X factor that can affect how prison works. But Brian explains that relationship isn't as cut and dried as you might think.
It wasn't inmates against guards unless there was a reason, in my opinion.
Many of the former correctional officers from McNeil that we spoke to agree with much of what Brian says. That includes Darren Filer, who worked on the island in the 90s and early 2000s.
I look back at McNeil Island was relatively laid back. When I say laid back, I mean by the amount of offender disturbances. There wasn't a ton of fights, you know. There were fights, they weren't uncommon. But when I compare it to Clallam Bay or Walla Walla or the Washington Reformatory in Monroe, the Clallam Bay still has the nickname of Gladiator School.
Take Brian. He's the one who compared prison to high school. After he got out, he became a wastewater treatment plant manager in Snohomish County. He's the kind of success story that prison officials will point to say prison is a place where people can turn their lives around. But as you talk to Brian, you'll hear the official programs and policies were all kind of secondary to his relationships.
I almost sound like I miss prison sometimes when I talk to people about it, and it's kind of sad because...
Well, you spent so much of your life there, your adult life, pretty much.
Yeah, I grew up, 19 years. So it's more intimate than even some people have with their own families. You know, you're living in an 8x10 cell with another man. You know, 19 years with friends and people that I consider some of the best people I've ever met in my life. And yes, they were criminals at one time, but they've changed and grown up. And there was guards that sat there and talked to me and listened to my story. They cared about my family. They would walk my family into trailer visits when my family would come. They would ask me questions about, you know, what are you going to do for a job when you get out, you know?
So I'm curious then, do you see your experience in prison as having been a net positive for your life or a net negative?
There's no way I would be the man and the person I am today. I take pride in knowing that I'm making almost $100,000 a year. I'm 4 years out of prison, but I would have liked to not done 19 years in prison to learn these lessons, and I feel like maybe 10 years would have been fine, and that's the truth.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect from KNKX. And today on the show, we're listening to excerpts from the podcast Forgotten Prison, which is produced by KNKX's Paula Whistle and Simone Alisea. So one of the episodes that you guys produced has the name Island Life, and it's sort of about all the things that are happening outside the concertina wire. Why did you want to look into that and explore it?
It was a huge part of the McNeil Island, and you had about 50 families connected in some way to the prison. The father or mother worked there who lived in homes on the island.
Yeah, and I think the thing that is maybe really surprising is just how fond people's memories are of having lived there.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, both, you know, there were people who worked there who liked working there, but especially their kids. Yeah. Kids who grew up on the island just have such strong memories of like this idyllic childhood of being on this island and getting to run around and picking blackberries and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And the other thing about the island is that it was more or less self-sustaining. And part of the reason it was able to be self-sustaining is because you had this pool of cheap labor in inmates.
They drove the school bus.
I would like to hear more about how that happened. let's take a listen to this piece from the podcast Forgotten Prison from KNKX right here on Sound Effect.
So here's how a mobster became a school bus driver. McNeil was a federal prison from when Washington became a state through the late 1970s. At the time, prisoners could work towards release and become known as trustees. In many cases, they helped sort of run things at a prison. On McNeil, that could mean daily interaction with families.
After the state took over the prison in 1981, most people say inmates were kept more separated from the families of those who worked there. But during the federal era, inmates took care of the lawns, operated the boats, and they drove kids to the schoolhouse on the island.
The ones that I came into contact with were very positive. You know, we saw them all the time when we took the boat back and forth.
The BOP years, we were kind of encouraged to speak with them and, you know, not to get too friendly, but to treat them with normal human dignity and not to, you know, like be like, oh, it's a prisoner, you know.
BOP means Bureau of Prisons, another way of describing the federal days. Ann Berkeley's dad was in charge of food at the prison. She also runs the McNeil Island Historical Society. She and others say the only time there was any real fear was when an alarm sounded to signal an escape attempt.
When that happened, families were generally instructed to just stay inside until the inmate was found, which they usually were.
But even then, Ann says, some of the older kids would hop in their cars and try to find whoever was escaping.
My friend Gary actually had saw an escape where the truck busted out the back gates. The guy just totally freaked.
The way Ann tells it, Gary was driving by and saw the inmate get shot from the tower.
not a normal childhood thing. But you never felt unsafe because it was always the idea like, the prisoners are not going to come to us. They're trying to get the heck away from the prison, and they certainly know not to mess with staff.
The stories where escaping inmates tried to intimidate staff or families are rare. Anne and others say that's because the punishment for messing with them could be severe.
When the state closed the prison on McNeil in 2011, the families had to leave. People who work at the commitment center all commute to the island. So the houses, the old chapel, they're all just rotting away like the prison is.
Many of the families we talk to are sad to hear what's become of their old neighborhood. When Becca and others talk about life on the island, some of them are brought to tears.
Can you tell me what makes this so emotional for you?
You know, I see how kids live now. And I see the community that we had on the island. And I wish all of my kids could experience the support of that kind of community. And it just is a happy time for me. And I wish that our society had a spot for more people to have that kind of experience. It was a really neat thing. The Friday night movies were...
So, Simone and Paula, did any of that come as a surprise to you?
Yeah, actually, it really, really did. Becca Ritchie is the last person you heard, and I interviewed her, and I was just shocked at how emotional she was.
Yeah.
You know, both in recounting how she had to leave the island when the state took over the prison, and also in hearing about when I told her sort of the state of the place, which is, you know, the houses are just as dilapidated as the prison is.
Falling apart.
Yeah. I mean, it made her really sad because it's like, you know, it's like losing your childhood home.
Wow. Wow. And we heard a lot about how those residents interacted with the inmates pretty regularly. And that gets to something that's really interesting about the work that you guys have been doing, I think, is that it really fills out the picture of what incarceration is all about. And I think raises some really interesting questions about what the point of it is. I mean, that may seem like an obvious question, right? But it's kind of complicated.
I don't know that it is an obvious question. I think most people sort of, you know, we have our criminal justice system. Prison is sort of the last stop in that system. And I think people just assume that we've always had it and it's always worked.
And that's not true. I mean, this idea of locking someone away as punishment for a crime is a fairly recent idea.
Yeah, basically, you know, since 1700s, if that.
Right. And you saw, you know, you see changes over time, more of a focus on rehabilitation or punishment. And, you know, in the 60s and in the 70s, you started to see behavioral science and more of a focus on kind of rehabilitation of prisoners.
Well, this question of who can be rehabilitated, who can be redeemed, kind of animates one of the great anecdotes in your podcast. And I'd love to listen to it right now. And it starts with you, Simone, on a dark and stormy night.
The wind and the rain whipped my face as I walked alone in the dark. I started up a narrow set of stairs outside an old Seattle home. I was here to see a man about Charles Manson.
Yes, that Charles Manson. In case you haven't heard of him, he was a notorious cult leader who had such power over his mostly young women followers that they were willing to kill for him. In the summer of 1969, the Manson family went on murder sprees, setting Los Angeles and the country on edge.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite, five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
Tate and the other victims had been shot and repeatedly stabbed. The word pig was found written in blood on the walls. Supposedly, Manson saw the murders as a way to somehow spark a race war that could lead to the apocalypse. Manson and several followers were convicted of murder and conspiracy and sentenced to life in prison. Charles Manson was still locked up in California when he died in 2017 at age 83.
But the man I went to see on that dark and stormy night met Charles Manson before all of that.
Leonard Shaw crossed paths with the soon-to-be cult leader in the early 60s, while Manson was doing time at the federal prison on McNeil Island.
Charlie was in the office one day, sitting there, and he and I just struck up a conversation.
Leonard is a psychotherapist who has done a lot of work in prisons. Back then, he was still getting his graduate degree at the University of Washington. Between 1962 and 1963, he did some field work at the McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary.
And he was an interesting person. He was obviously pretty bright. And so I said, well, why don't I ask Putman to put you on my counseling list so we can talk every week.
Putman is Lawrence Putman, who was the warden of McNeil at the time. Leonard and Charlie, as Manson was known then, talked for about an hour a week during Leonard's few months at the prison.
Back then, prison officials and other inmates mostly saw Charlie Manson as just some punk. He was 28 years old then, and he'd already been in and out of correctional institutions most of his life for stealing cars and pimping out girls. He ended up at McNeil through a combination of prostitution and check forgery.
Did you see him as irredeemable when you were working with him?
That's an interesting question. I never thought about him that way. But when I look back on it, I'm not sure if I had any kind of a constructive impact on him at all.
From McNeil, he was transferred to a minimum security prison in California, and he was paroled from there in 1967. He became drawn to the Summer of Love crowds in San Francisco, where he began to build his following. That, of course, eventually culminated in those murder sprees around Los Angeles 2 years later, which almost immediately became a symbol of the darkest aspects of humanity.
One officer summed up the murders when he said, "In all my years, I have never seen anything like this before."
In his biography of Manson, author Jeff Gwynn writes about lessons young Charlie learned while he was on McNeil Island. He was drawn to Scientology, seeing it as one way he might manipulate women into prostituting for him once he got out. It was also on McNeil that he polished his guitar skills. One guard said he was a real hit at the talent shows. And he listened to the Beatles on the radio in his cell. He later used music to attract followers and build his philosophies about racial war, which he referred to as Helter Skelter. Helter Skelter.
Helter Skelter. The thing is, prison officials at the time saw Charlie's interests as good things. Inmates finding faith has long been considered rehabilitative, but for most of history, that was limited to Christianity. In the 60s, that thinking was starting to expand to other religions. Art and literature programs also picked up around this time, and prison officials wrote that Charlie's musical ambitions helped him stay out of trouble in the last years he was on McNeil Island.
So what happened? How is it that Manson went from petty criminal to someone who was able to command others to murder for him?
A lot has been written about Manson and this question, but Leonard, the psychotherapist who met with Charlie at McNeil as a graduate student, provides a little bit of insight as to what role the prison played. He says people were skeptical when he first offered to counsel Charlie.
Charlie knew everybody considered him a waste of time.
When you say waste of time, what do you mean by that?
He'd been in and out of prisons ever since he was 13 years old or something, you know. So he was considered a hopeless case.
Did you feel any sense of that the prison could have done something different or these other institutions could have done something different, that something else could have happened, or did it seem like a foregone conclusion?
I don't know if somebody took a personal interest in Charlie when he was a juvenile. I'm open to that possibility, but by the time I met him, characterologically, he was so fixed. I had no idea he was going to pull something like he did, but I certainly felt it fit with his personality type.
You're hearing excerpts from the podcast Forgotten Prison from CanKX right here on Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer here with Simone Alisea and Paula Whistle. Kind of gives me the willies. Did you guys know that that Manson was an inmate there?
No, not until we started research on this.
Yeah, like, and most people don't know that. Or they think you say, oh, Charlie Manson was there. You think, oh, he was there after the murders in L.A. somehow, which is not accurate.
Well, the case of Manson and some of these other well-known high-profile inmates again brings up this question of whether there are some people who just can't be redeemed, who really just need to be locked up forever, potentially. And those are questions that are really just shot through in the most recent chapter of McNeil Island's history here. And this is the chapter that we call the Special Commitment Center. Can you guys just explain what that is? Because the Special Commitment Center doesn't like come up in prison movies and stuff like that. This is a particular unique kind of a thing, right?
Well, and it's actually not a prison. It is actually a civil commitment facility, and it's where the state locks up people they have labeled sexually violent predators after they've done their prison time. So they are supposed to be there for treatment with the idea that they can get out. But, you know, what we found is, what, the first 16 years, no one actually was released.
Correct. Washington State was the first state to do this in 1990. And a lot of other states have followed suit. I think people are very surprised to hear, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled it constitutional several times. Lots of states do this. I think 20 states total. And it's been going on for many, many years.
And this is designed specifically for so-called sexually violent predators, right? Mm-hmm. And that gets into these issues of, you know, can those folks ever truly be rehabilitated? Are they always going to be a danger?
But legally, there has to be some path to release. You can't just say, I think they're dangerous and lock them up forever. So there has to be some way for them to work their way out of the commitment center. But it is very difficult.
You guys bring this to life really vividly in the podcast when you introduce us to one of the residents of the Special Commitment Center. We are going to meet her now. We're also going to meet her victim. And I just want to give a heads up that this piece contains some pretty difficult content related to sexual assault. So a heads up if you have children listening or if you'd rather not hear. It lasts about 9 minutes.
Laura, can I have you introduce yourself?
My name is Laura McCollum. And I've been here since 1995 of November.
We sat down with resident Laura McCollum in a visiting room inside the Special Commitment Center.
But I still meet with a therapist, I meet with her once a week for like 2 hours. So just do the best I can. I
sleep. When we told people we were visiting a resident at the Commitment Center, a lot of them said, aren't you scared? The truth is, Laura and this place all seem sort of ordinary in an institutional way. People watching TV, playing cards, but the question speaks to the public perception of this term, sexually violent predator. Laura, like everyone here, has been given that label by the state.
And even though I understand what I did was wrong and it was really, really bad, I don't think I deserve just to be stuck here and forgot about, like, you know, you don't exist. And I feel like that's happened to everybody here.
Laura was placed in the commitment center after completing a 5.5-year prison sentence for child rape in the first degree. She didn't want to talk about her crime, but according to Pierce County court records, Laura pleaded guilty in 1990 to having oral sex with a 2-year-old girl, a child she often babysat. She later told interviewers she was sexually attracted to very young children and would befriend mothers to gain access to them.
Pretty much all the other residents here are men. Laura was the first woman in the country to ever be labeled a sexually violent predator. She's been at the commitment center for more than 20 years.
I don't think I'm predatory as a person. I think that's a behavior I did. But me as a person, I'm just me. I'm Laura. And I can change and not do predatory acts.
Reports from analysts in the court records trace Laura's crimes to abuse she herself suffered as a child, a pattern that's pretty common among residents at the commitment center. The records also indicate that before she was arrested, Laura sought mental health treatment, saying she had urges to molest children,
But from what we can tell, no one took any action, and she continued to have access to kids. She actually elected to come here, feeling it might help her. But now she seems to regret that move.
Unlike prison, where you have a set release date, people here are committed indefinitely. But you're supposed to be able to get out through treatment. Residents can be released unconditionally or with restrictions. Laura is trying for that second option.
I'll have a chaperone, so when I go to the store, you know, or I go to the doctor, I'll have somebody with me so I'm accounted for.
Getting out of the SCC isn't easy. In the nearly three decades the Commitment Center has been operating, the state has tried to send 478 people here and has successfully committed most of them. Of those who have been committed, about 80 have been released unconditionally. And even if you're willing to remain under supervision, there are a lot of hoops to go through, like finding housing or sometimes having to go through another trial. People who do get off the island also face pushback from neighbors. So residents like Laura say they're in a no-win situation, forever tied to what they did.
Most of us would probably rather not think about those so-called sexually violent predators out on that island in South Puget Sound. But forgetting about the Commitment Center has real consequences for people like Laura. At 61 years old, she has just one hope when it comes to McNeil Island.
I don't want to die in this place. I can't imagine what it was like to be an inmate here and be buried in a place that didn't even mark your grave. To have this stigma and to die here too, that's just like... I at least hope I'm on the other side, you know. At least I won't say I died on the island, you know.
While some residents do eventually get out, for most, it's day after day, year after year of waiting with no end in sight.
All of these guys, in my opinion, could get out of here if this place would really, really work with them and they would stop feeding the stigma to the news of who we are, how we are, what we are. We're not who we were. I'm not who I was 30 years ago. I'm not who I was 5 years ago.
But if Laura ever were to leave the island, one woman in Tacoma says she would be terrified.
I don't think that she should be ever let out. I believe, you know, she should be in there for a lifetime.
Amber was Laura's victim, the one Laura pleaded guilty to raping when Amber was very, very young. Amber's now 33. We talked to her and her father, William, in their apartment in Tacoma's Hilltop neighborhood. We're only using their first names to protect their privacy.
Amber and William keep close track of Laura. As a victim, Amber gets notified when Laura speaks to the media, which is why she reached out to us. When Laura is trying for release, Amber sends letters to the state explaining why she thinks Laura should never get out of the Commitment Center. All these years later, she's still afraid of what Laura might do. Now, she doesn't remember what Laura did to her because she was so young at the time, but she and her father say Amber was about 9 when she found out.
How it happened is I went into my dad's living room and I found these videos and it said Amber 1, Amber 2. And I was like, oh, what is that, you know? And so I popped them in the movie thing, and I was on the news. My whole, you know, everything that happened with Laura, you know, everything. And I didn't know nothing about it because I was a year and a half.
And so after that, she went into therapy. William, who got custody of Amber after the abuse, says Amber acted out and struggled in school for years.
So do you really blame Laura for all of this that has happened to you?
Yep, I do. I don't know.
My feeling is, we talked about it before you two came today, and I asked Amber, I said, do you really want to put yourself through this, you know? And she goes, yeah. And I asked her, what do you want Laura to know? What do you want the world to know or understand? And she told me, she said, she goes, the biggest thing I want people to understand is to know that she hurt a lot of people, not only me, but a lot of other kids out there. Why should her sentence be cut loose other than a life sentence, because she gave her nothing but a life sentence, because she's still hurting today.
Keep in mind, Laura wasn't sentenced to life. She already served her prison time. Although her commitment is indefinite, she's supposed to have a chance to get out. But William brings up something else here, too. Even though Laura was only convicted in the one case, the court records from the 80s indicate she did admit to abusing other children. Amber and William have read interviews with Laura over the years, and based on those, Amber says she doesn't believe Laura when she says she's changed.
So, Amber, I have a question. Is there any room, do you think, for redemption, forgiveness for someone like Laura, or the other people there?
The other people, maybe, because I don't know their cases, you know, obviously, you know, but Laura... She's sick.
Amber and William's fear is very real. And like a lot of the general public, they don't really distinguish between prison and the special commitment center. So long as Laura's locked away, they think the state's doing its job. Any debate about treatment or whether it's right to lock people up based on what they might do in the future doesn't really matter to them because they feel safer.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and I'm here with Simone Alisea and Paula Whistle, listening to their podcast, Forgotten Prison. So, Paula, Simone, having been at it for many months now on this project, why do you think it's important for this forgotten prison to be remembered?
It kind of speaks to our attitude about prisons, out of sight, out of mind. And there's a great stigma attached to people who come out of prison. So many times they don't even talk about it to other people. So it just sort of builds that stigma around it. But, you know, we're paying for our prisons. I mean, McNeil is closed now. Special Commitment Center is still there. But it's important to know what's been done in the past in our name.
And the other thing, too, I'll say is, you know, again, we see prisons as being a necessary part of our criminal justice system. And if we do see it as being a necessary part, we should probably have a better sense of what's going on. You know, there hasn't really been an effort to collect this history until now.
Well, that history is collected in the 6 episodes of Forgotten Prison, a podcast produced here at KNKX by Paula Whistle and Simone Alisea. Thank you both so much for sharing some of it with Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy, who also edited the Forgotten Prison podcast. That series is produced by Simone Alisea and Paula Whistle. Additional editing and mixing by Bethany Denton. Original music by Bill Anschel. Thanks also to Mary Michael Stump and Gwen Whiting with the State History Museum, and Dave Beals, who did a lot of the early research. This project is made possible in part by Humanities Washington. So listen up, now you have 2 podcasts to subscribe to, Sound Effect and Forgotten Prison. They're both on Apple Podcasts and in all the other usual places, and you can see all the stuff we have on offer at knkx.org/podcast. You can send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org, and meet me back here next week when our theme is Daddy Issues. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.